Now we're going to be talking about something which, for me, could mean that we're here for the rest of the hour. And it's a survey on the mispronunciation of words and what you find most irritating. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Chris Mulhall. He is, of course, an Athaiman. He's also a lecturer in language at WIT and a lexicographer. Chris, you're welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, delighted to do so. I have many mispronunciation bugbears, but what's interesting about this is that so many of us find how people mispronounce two words specifically and probably the most irritating. And I'm not never really sure how specifically morphed into pacifically.
No, I think in those cases, Ciara, there's probably three backgrounds for why we would mispronounce words. And one you've mentioned there is where there's two words that are sort of similar in shape and we tend to merge them incorrectly, which as you said, specifically and then pacifically, obviously with pacific and specific being quite similar in sound. Other reasons for that occurring, Ciara, are that the brain in around language loves shortcuts. So when we see collections of letters that are similar at the front and at the end, start and finish, we tend to swallow the word whole instead of taking it in each of the constituent components in turn. So if the first and last letters are the same, we tend to adopt a shortcut and we say we'll pronounce it this way, rightly or wrongly. And do you know what, Ciara? I suppose this sounds a bit strange coming from a linguist on my end, but you know, people sometimes, I think 25% of the population get bothered by that stuff, you know, sometimes. But for the most part, people don't even pick up on it and mightn't even register with them that someone has made a mistake because we're speaking so fluently and so quickly that one blip on the horizon doesn't make a big deal sometimes with some people. But then another, it's a big deal. And you know what, then from certain ends, people will say they'll pick you up on it or you'll correct someone in public on it, which can be a little bit socially intrusive, you know.
I'm among the 25%, I think, which will come as a surprise to no one, that would be irritated. That's not to say I don't mispronounce words myself.
Yeah.
Clearly,
yeah.
I do. But in normal, everyday conversation, I would never dream of correcting somebody else.
No, me neither, because, you know, like languages, even at a very young age when we start to learn language is effectively a vector of our confidence. And that's why, you know, talkative children, in preschool and early school years are quite socially magnetic, you know, because people will go to them because they speak and whatever else a lot and they have a lot to say and they're maybe seen as a source of information and knowledge. But if you correct someone repetitively, I mean, no doubt it does infringe on their social confidence and their oral confidence. And being a language lecturer as well myself, and I teach French and Italian, is that you have to manage that, how often you correct someone. If you're doing it all the time, you're just going to evaporate any goodwill someone has towards learning and making mistakes. It's a really fine balance, Ciara.
And I would also imagine, because, and you've kind of alluded to this, Chris, an awful lot of us learn words hourly only, long before we see them written.
Exactly.
So things like moo point, you're not going to hear the T when somebody is saying moot all the time unless they enunciate it particularly well. Axe for ask, especially, etc. Demeanor for demeanor. Chicago is a wonderfully Irish word. I think a lot of our quote-unquote mispronunciations are in fact arguably Hiberno-English.
Yes, they are. You hit the nail on the head there, by the way. And it brings an interesting area of thinking, is that, you know, like when you encourage independent reading, largely from younger age kids, is that a lot of their space, they're reading in a monologue. So they're reading the words, saying it to themselves, and they're having no external input into the sound of that word. And that actually can be problematic then as you get on and you recognize the word as a graphical object, but not as an oral object. So you know how it's spelled, possibly, in most cases, maybe some a little bit difficult for kids and others, but then you've never heard it being pronounced. And that creates a big, big issue. And where we have, I think, difficulties in understanding words like that are, you know, when words are borrowed from other languages. So one of the references in the article that brings this up, although it's been well mooted actually over the years, like espresso instead of people say expresso. That's largely because we see the word express in English and say, well, look, it must be, it's the rule I'm going with sort of first and last letters look the same, you know?
Yeah.
And then you'll get little variations in areas like, for example, you might hear cousined. You might hear the D creeping onto the end of cousin sometimes. And then you will get foreign language knowledge that maybe you can't expect the person to know the pronunciation. For example, you'll hear paella as opposed to paella. So you have to have a knowledge of the language it's coming from and the sound systems for that.
And arguably words like paella, it's correct in Hiberno-English to say paella. Yeah. But if I'm taking myself off to Spain and pretending that I speak Spanish, I'll get an awful lot of side eyes if I say paella.
Yeah, well, what I often think, and I see this when I'm abroad, is they can, native language speakers of a language you're trying to speak, will I be able to separate you immediately on the sound out of your mouth? So, like, in terms of accent studies, and I've done studies on accents, is that, like, you can tell where someone's from within, like, 5 seconds of hearing them, and then you will form stereotyped views absolutely. And, like, that happens even within our own country, you know, like, an accent from one ear or another, we'll have certain feelings or emotions towards that region, good, bad or indifferent. So yeah, that separates people really quickly. And what I would find then in those conversations when you're pronouncing those words incorrectly is that they will tend to speak back to you in your native language, which can be really frustrating for a language learner, you know. But Hiberno-English, but again, Kira, you've hit very intuitively on the point that English is by itself a pretty poorly formed language in terms
isn't it though? I mean, it's robbed from every language virtually that it's come into contact with, which is great in terms of its evolutionary path, but it has taken little of the music, little of the linguistic rules that most of the source languages would have had.
Yes, absolutely. And that creates a problem. Even within English, you'll find, for example, my kids were spelling a word yesterday, actually, from homework. It was trousers, you know. And like I've seen, like, the first four letters of that is the French word pou, which means hole. And then you can get some sort of logic as to where the word comes from, you know. But often, in terms of Irish, you'll find that the Irish spelling of a word is actually closer to the French word. So I'll give you a quick example. So argent in French is money or silver. And argent in Irish is money. It's silver, and you will find argento in Italian and argento in Spanish as well. But then you have silver in English and money that just seem to come out of nowhere. So we're all the time dealing in English in a language, as you've said, that seems to have a multi-factor structure in it, and that the rules aren't continuous. But from a learner perspective, then, where we pick up on stuff, like, for example, you might have people who have difficulty spelling words like receive and believe because they don't think it's E before I or I before E or whatever it is. But then we'll find words in language, like, for example, where it grabs our attention, where we can't swallow it as a whole. So think of words like pneumonia, alibi, tsunami. You know, we like, okay, I have to look at that because that's unusual, because many words in English end in T and I, for example, in the case of tsunami, or A and I in the case of alibi. So that's where we get attracted into a space. Now, traditionally, these spaces may be Latin origin, like tsunami or pneumonia, and they come from other languages. But we're sort of, I would say, numbed or neutralized to a lot of the effect in English because we have been so used to it and we've stopped looking at it. And even words recently, like, you know, like quinoa. You know, like that. When
which
I first
we all
that,
originally said as quinoa.
Quinoa, exactly. Like, we said, we talk about quinoa salad. The minute I had heard that word for the first time, I thought that's K-E-E-N-W-A in my head. But not knowing anything else clear. But that's exactly where we all are as speakers. And that's an evolving space for us to learn a language and to come along. And I'll tell you an interesting one about, I remember there was a horse many years ago, actually, from a tie in Cheltenham. And the broadcaster was calling it Ati Spirit. You know, so sometimes we just have to evolve by listening to the speaker and saying, how did he pronounce that? You know, or how did they pronounce it? And part of it is actually accepting, look, you just don't know it, and getting on with it. Other examples, prescription instead of prescription. You will find then sort of nuances, schedule, controversy. That's got to do with stressing. So that's called prosody in language, where some people put a stress on other elements. And that's why there's problems in, for example, Italian words. So 25% of English speakers approximately, again, would report difficulty with Italian words because they don't know where the stress is in it. So you'll hear then bruschetta, bruschetta. So there'll be differences in that. Tagliatelle, tagliatelle. So and there's sound differences. But yeah, I think we're disadvantaged sometimes as English speakers learning another language because we have to deal with a whole ream of the forms and sounds that are all from different spaces, and when we're targeted in one space to learn something, we just have to focus on that, you know, so it's a bit tough for us.
One thing that's just occurred to me is that there can be a single word which is two separate forms of pronunciation, and I'm thinking specifically of Hiberno-English, and therefore two different meanings. And the word I'm thinking of is contrary and contrary.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So the alternate pronunciation which we have developed here has its own attaching meaning.
Yes, exactly. So what you have in that case, they are homographs. and that are independent, that are homophonic, independent homophonics. So they have the same spelling, but their meaning is different attached to their sound. It's a really complex area in language, Ciara. I mean, you're so good in language, actually, I have to say credit to you here live on air for your absolute extraordinary knowledge. It's brilliant, really. But yeah, that is a very complex space. So what we have to do is create a separate entry in the brain for the sound and meaning, but we treat the spelling as the same. So it's a cognitive challenge for any learner. And that sort of gives you an insight into how sophisticated our brains are dealing with language and how we compute it so quickly. But the dangers of computing it quickly is that we, how will I put it like this, we look rather than see, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
We have to actually zero in and say, that's not espresso, it's espresso. And it's just in those minute things that the irritation can cause. And you know what, Ciara, I'll join the club as well. I'm slightly irritated by the times, but you know what? There's so much idiosyncratic speech that you roll with the punches, you know?
At what point does the quote-unquote mispronunciation become the accepted pronunciation? Is it a point of saturation in a society or a community?
Now, that's an interesting question, is that, you see, there's no... The issue with English, I think, is that if we cast our eyes into Europe, we have... look, we see what are language academies. So you will find in France you have the Académie Française, which really controls and monitors the language and tells you what's good, bad or indifferent or what's not allowed in it. The space in English and Hiberno English is that we have effectively nearly every continent speaking English. And there is no one set rule for English in terms of this is the way something should be pronounced because the geographical variation is so wide on it. So there's probably no space where we can go in English and say, actually, you're pronouncing that wrong, because the geography and the sound of the region will largely influence it. And I saw an interesting case, you know, like... you might find in the UK, they won't say probably, they say probably, you know, where they'll just shorten it, you get clipping, which is called in language. Is anyone wrong at any point? You see, if you factor in, like, there may be speech impairments, there may be a regional accent, you know, and all of that. I mean, to say something's been pronounced wrong sounds quite elocuted in these days, you know, where someone will say, okay, this is the way to be pronounced, standard. But then you're looking back, and I know I've mentioned this before, as a BBC model almost, you know, where every word, and then you get to the point of issue rather than issue, you know, where it's actually almost over-exaggerated and it stands out as opposed to being the norm. So it's very, English is a really, really hard space to look into linguistics, because there's no one size fits all. And that's pretty tough. And as I said prior, that makes it complicated for us to go out into a language and learn stuff, because the base is so unstable from where we come from. You know?
Well, Dr. Chris Mulhall, it's always a pleasure. That's Chris Mulhall, lecturer in language at WIT, lexicographer and a Thigh Man. We've had a caller get in touch saying his or her pet peeves for mispronunciation are clothes for clothes and axe for ask, and they drive him or her mad. Also, Denise in a Thigh has gotten in touch on WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97, saying what annoys me isn't exactly a word mispronounced, but the name O'Donoghue being pronounced with the American Donoghue. It's so annoying. I'm not sure that I've done that justice, Denise, but I totally know where you're coming from. As always, the lines are open. Comments, requests, dedications, text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about the Reuters Digital News Report for Ireland, and we'll hear from the Licensed Vintners Association. The keynote Reuters Digital News Report for Ireland has been released today, and there's some very interesting findings, in particular in terms of the public's trust in their sources of news. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Professor Colleen Murrell. She's a professor of journalism at DCU and a lead researcher at the Institute of Future Media, Democracy and Society at Dublin City University. Colleen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
First off, do you have any sense as to why this particular news report was conducted in conjunction with the BAI, the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland? And I suppose the headline figure is that the trust has increased marginally. Is that a surprise to you, given in particular the social media commentary on trust in news sources?
Well, trust in news is up 5%, so that's actually not really that marginal, considering that this is a longitudinal survey and things generally just kind of creep up 1 or 2%. So in that case, we can get quite excited by 5%. That's trust in particular sort of established brands. It's certainly not the same for trust in social media.
Mm.
So I think what perhaps coronavirus has done has sent people looking for trusted places to find the information that they need about COVID-19, lockdowns, rollouts, etc. So yes, they are going to places like TV, radio, well-known newspaper brands.
And they're doing so more frequently and in greater numbers, but there is, Colleen, some kind of variation between different age cohorts as well, particularly the 18 to 24 and the over 65s.
Yes. For example, trust in news that people access via social media is down, and older groups, particularly people who are over 65, are particularly worried about this. Younger people say that they see a lot of disinformation, misinformation, for example, about COVID-19, but they don't seem to be as bothered by it. Then again, when they're asked, where have you seen, you know, what's the subject that you've seen most disinformation about? They say coronavirus at 49%.
Mm.
And where are they seeing that? I think it was 38%, Facebook. So Facebook definitely has a problem there that they have to deal with. I know that they are trying to deal with it. They've set up an oversight board, and they've got these COVID-19 notifications now that go out on news reports. But it's still perceived as being the place where there's too much misinformation and disinformation going on.
Some of the other types of mis or disinformation that people encountered most frequently included politics at 28%, 25% celebrities, climate change or the environment 19%, immigration 16%, other health issues and products and services. What was also interesting, which the study has revealed, Colleen, is how and where people are electing to access their news media. So 23% local radio or their website, so that would be us here at KFM Radio, 13% local newspapers or free sheets, another 13% were just going directly through Google, and I would imagine had a specific topic in mind that they were searching for information on. What's concerning is the number of people going through WhatsApp. They were 2% getting their local information or COVID-19 health information from WhatsApp. 5% were not getting it from anywhere. 9% other internet or sites or apps, and 5% independent websites serving a small neighbourhood. There's about three of those particular cohorts, Colleen, that seem to be rife for disinformation, and I'm not saying that automatically because these are small-scale sources that they are conferring upon us disinformation, but it would seem more probable.
Yes, and I think that this shows, though, that people tend to stick more with what they know, and therefore older people, for example, go straight to websites. Or they might look through Google, but they will go straight to the Irish Times website, for example, your station, RTE, wherever it is. Whereas younger people have got this whole different range of platforms, aggregators, enablers, if you like, influencers, that they go to see news, they go to collect their news via. So yes, it's entirely possible that along the way they are being fed disinformation and misinformation. On the plus side, though, you know, there are some quite astounding statistics, like the fact that TV news viewing is up 8% to 41%. So that's really significant in Ireland.
Particularly,
and it's up in the UK as well.
Sorry, Colleen, particularly when you contrast it with the number of people who have gone out and actively bought streaming services over the course of the pandemic. So they have elected for their general viewing to move away or watch less television, but are making the active and conscious decision to watch television broadcast news.
Yes, and that's what's surprising, I suppose. And you know, if I was a news director in a media outfit right now, I'd be happy that we seem to be attracting younger people to watch news bulletins. But of course, you know, this could just be a blip, because younger people, particularly the 18 to 24 cohort, are mostly going to be at home in lockdowns. So while they're at home in lockdowns, they're sort of stuck on the sofa while perhaps their parents put on the television. That won't account for everybody, but that there's probably a large percentage of that. But, you know, again, trying to find a better view of this would be, well, perhaps they'll catch the news bug while they're there, you know, because we have certainly been watching a lot of news this year one way or another, whether it's health press conferences, government press conferences, news bulletins, whatever.
Financing of news media is also an issue. We've seen increasingly that publications, in particular newspapers, have had to put or have elected to put many of their articles behind paywalls because they have bills to pay. And people will have certain reactions to that. Some people are outraged by it. Others are there, well, look, I was going to buy the hard copy paper anyway. I may as well just get it delivered straight to my phone. But the number of people electing to pay for access to news media has gone up by 4% in Ireland.
Yeah, and again, that is quite significant because, and how much of that is a lockdown effect is hard to tell, because it could be that there were fewer people going out and buying a newspaper because in lockdowns and because of public health messages, people didn't want to go out necessarily so often to the shops to pick up a printed document, you know, because of worries about infection. So perhaps people have therefore at home finally had to bite the bullet and get a subscription. And interestingly, young people have got more, are getting more subscriptions, but only one, maximum two, and that's down to money. Like, so the well-paid are getting sometimes up to five and more news-related subscriptions, whereas for young people it's one, maximum two.
So, and then we have the really interesting dichotomy that 16% of people in Ireland pay actively and consciously to access particular sources of news. But well over half of people have reported some level of concern about the financial state of commercial news organisations in Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the majority, but it is, Ireland is significantly ahead in this. Versus, say, America or North America and the UK. So I think it was 37%, I don't have the figures in front of me, are concerned about the state of commercial news, and also some are quite happy for the government to intervene. And these are the sorts of issues that are up at the moment before the Future of Media Commission in determining how to make a viable news media flourish in these difficult times, particularly with lost advertising.
Arguably, Colleen, we'll have to wait until this time next year for the post-hard lockdown study of trust in news media and engagement with news media to see if this one is a blip.
Yeah, because, the TV viewing could well be a blip. I mean, if you think back to 9/11, for example, lots of people were terribly excited that, say, Americans in particular were suddenly really interested in international news because they wanted to know, what the hell happened there? Why don't we know about news in Afghanistan or Pakistan or wherever? But that did die away. That only lasted a couple of years, and then, they stopped being interested in international news anymore. So that could be the case with television, but it is showing well, especially amongst public service broadcasters in Europe. So all of those are up, and in Ireland in particular.
Well, Professor Colleen Murrell, Professor of Journalism at DCU and indeed a keynote member of the Institute for Future Media, Democracy and Society, FUJO, at Dublin City University. Thanks for joining us. I suppose many restaurateurs, many publicans are tearing their hair out at this point at rumblings over the last couple of days that there could be some kind of editing, some kind of pushing back of the July 5th reopening of indoor dining and drinking that's being attributable to the possible risk posed by the Delta variant of COVID-19. I'm joined now by Noel Anderson. He's chair of the Licensed Vintners Association. He's also managing director of The Bridge 1859 and The Lemon and Duke in Dublin City Centre. Noel, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me on.
I would imagine your members are eyeing up any reportage about the Delta variant with grave concern because of the logistical and economic challenges it could pose for them.
Yeah, I think tearing your hair out was a good analogy. Yeah, look, that's the thing, really. You know, we have to have time to organise, to get ourselves set up. You know, a couple of days, 2-3 days notice to get open, it's just totally unfeasible. Like, the big thing for us is people are kind of saying, oh, could you not wait another 3 or 4 weeks? The big thing for us is our staff. We're losing staff hand over fist to other industries every day. And this could be another thing that, like, I myself have lost a lot of staff to industries. So it's other industries, and it's just really concerning that we could end up losing more, you know.
So in theory, would it be easier, Noel, if the government came out, let's say, on Friday and said, no, July 5th isn't happening, it's happening 3 weeks later?
As hard as and all as that would be to take, yes, is the quick answer. Because you need to be able to organise staff and stock and suppliers and rosters and the whole, and bookings, you know, it's another thing. We have a huge amount of bookings coming in. You have to cancel them and try and rebook them and all that sort of stuff. So it's just not realistic to think that 3 or 4 days' notice can sort this out.
And what I can understand where you know, government is coming from on this. They want to leave it as long as is possible in order to make a decision that is as reflective of the COVID-19 situation as close to July 5th as is feasible. And from a public health standpoint, that makes sense. But from a commercial standpoint, it doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. Look, and I get it. I get it from every which side. You know, it's a very difficult decision for everybody, but I mean, the COVID variant is in circulation in the UK, it's in circulation in the North, it's in circulation in Europe. But we're the, like, absolute outliers in Europe and the world when in terms of hospitality. And unfortunately, it kind of has to come to some point where we're going to have to make decisions to kind of to move on. But, like, to date, the LVA and the VFI have followed public health guidance to the letter of the law at all times. But we have members, you know, 40% of pubs in Ireland are closed 464 days today. They are in an absolutely intolerable position. I'm lucky enough in a way that I'm open, I can trade, I have some staff back. But I have very, very close friends that are literally at the end of their tether, not knowing whether they're going to trade or not. And genuinely, their main concern is, will they be able to hold on to the staff that they have?
And I would imagine those close friends, those LVA members of whom you've spoken, Noel, this time last week were literally counting the minutes to July 5th. And now, because of the reportage this week of the number of the Delta variant cases in Ireland and decisions that could be taken because of that, are almost dreading it because they know that it's a certainty.
No, absolutely. My phone nearly went into meltdown this morning and people asking me for advice of should they organise stock, should they bring back staff. And I couldn't tell them that. I mean, the off feeling I had this morning was deja vu, here we go again, the senior political correspondence being leaked, you know, news, and it just feels very much like, here we go again, they're trying to soften us up for some bad news next week. And that's ultimately the feeling that I have in the bottom of my stomach, and it's just like, oh no, here we are again, when we didn't think that this would come again. I mean, at this point, we need to really see some sort of dividends from vaccines. By the time the 5th of July comes on, there'll be 4 million vaccines administered. I think they've done a really good job in the vaccine front, and we've got to really start seeing dividends. We've got to get back to some sort of life. It's been horrible for everybody, but you know, we can't keep going the way we're going.
In terms then of staff, you've noted that is a huge issue, not only for you but for an awful lot of your members. To what industries are they going, and how are you going to replace them?
Well, I lost both of my head chefs to the construction industry, just to give a very quick, easy example. And people are leaving our sector to go to hotels because they're open, they're trading. What are people getting out of the industry altogether? Some people have left the country. An awful lot of our kind of foreign staff went home when this all started. And we are having a job of work to try to replace them. But one thing I'm seeing now is that rate of pay are obviously going up a lot higher because, you know, supply and demand. And unfortunately, like, the staff just aren't out there at the minute. You know, they're not there. I mean, I was lucky enough to retain about 90% of my staff, but others certainly haven't been. We're just going to have to try and battle on. You know, we just really are.
Is it a case, Noel, that some of your members may not be able to open in the way that they would wish because they cannot get people to staff their floor?
Yeah, there's that, but also a lot of members can't open the way they want to as well. Like, a lot of small pubs and stuff, they rely on the counter business, so even when we open back up, we're not opening as normal. I think that's been missed a lot of the time. So we're still opening with restrictions. We're still opening with staff being masked and all the social distancing in place. So, you know, we're not going back to a free-for-all here and nowhere near it. And I think that's been missed in the debate here as well, you know.
Noel Anderson, Chair of the Licensed Vintners Association, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, the Central Statistics Office has released its Life at Home survey, which looked at the period May to June of this year. And it has shown that lone parents are bearing a disproportionate level of hardship and discrimination. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Karen Kiernan, Chief Executive of One Family. Karen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
There are around 20,000 people parenting alone here in County Kildare, and I think when people talk about those that are parenting alone, they forget that there are as many reasons for that way of life than you and I have had hot dinners.
Oh, everyone's story is different, I suppose, and that's what we know from working with families is, in fact, many people are sharing parenting of their children to a greater or lesser extent, sometimes in a very positive way and sometimes in a very conflictual way. Some people might be completely on their own with their child or children. Some people have been bereaved. Some are separated or divorced. Some people, a minority of people, may never really have had a relationship with the other parent, but they're trying to make it work for the sake of the child. So there's every kind of possible situation, but we do know that we see too many lone parents and their children in homeless accommodation or in poverty or not able to work full time. You know, so there are certain characteristics that are common amongst people who are trying to do it all on their own.
And this, the CSO's survey shows 68% of people parenting alone are often under financial pressure. Like, that's a huge proportion. I know everybody on occasion may feel the pinch, some more than others, but for that proportion of a single group of people to be under financial pressure says quite a lot.
We're not one bit surprised. Every single study and piece of research done shows this over and over again, whether it's a local piece of research, whether it's done by the EU or the government. People who are parenting alone have less money, they have less ability to earn money, they have poor living conditions, less savings, and it's just much more difficult for them to manage on a week-to-week basis. So it's no surprise that two-thirds of lone parents are saying they're often under financial pressure. And that's really tough to keep living like that, because if something goes wrong, you know, an appliance breaks down, a child is sick, you know, there's an extra bill for something. It's so difficult to manage because there's nowhere to go. So frequently under financial pressure is a really hard way to live your life. It's very stressful.
And I would imagine perhaps that the flippant or unthinking response to that would be either we'll get a job or get a better job. But there are a series of barriers that people parenting alone have to surmount in order to do that.
Yeah, I mean, we sometimes see lone parents who will actually earn less money by coming maybe off of social welfare payment into work so that they can try and get enough experience to get a better job. Mm-hmm. Because the whole idea, so the way things are set up in Ireland is you kind of need two good incomes to pay for the basics. And the basics are roof over your head and childcare. And it's very hard to pay for both of those things, plus all the other bills and things associated with children, but it's very hard to do that on one income. And it's very hard to do it on a part-time income. In fact, it's not possible. And you need a well-paid job. So I suppose part of what we're saying as well is what many parents need is a bit of help with education. They need help to get through a degree so that they can get a job that's good enough so that they can earn enough money to completely move off welfare, out of poverty for their family. And some people have managed to do that, and it's fantastic when it works. But if you're held back and the kinds of barriers and restrictions that are there that stop people being able to do as well as they can, that's really hard to see. But there are solutions, and we just need government to look at all these reports that they've paid for and implement the recommendations.
Two really, really awful statistics, Karen, contained in this Pulse survey. 59% of lone parents report feeling lonely all or most of the time. And 48% of lone parents said they often experience judgmental attitudes or exclusion as a lone parent. Who is doing that?
We've done surveys before on shame. And we also, because we work with parents and we listen to them every day, we know how they feel about things. And so people feel that they're being judged, and sometimes they are being judged. People feel under scrutiny, perhaps because they need a social welfare payment, maybe because of how they've been treated by a government department or something careless that somebody else has said, or because they're not able to participate in society because they don't have enough income to do so, or the children can't go to a birthday party, or they can't go for a cup of coffee with other parents, or they don't get asked to things socially, maybe because they don't have a partner. So there's lots of different ways in which this can happen. And there's very old research going back 15 years which showed the most socially isolated people in Ireland are not bachelors living up the side of a mountain. It is lone parents. They are the most socially isolated and now here lonely people. And it's because anyone who's a parent knows it's fabulous, but it's a really tough job. And if you're doing that day in, day out on your own, or you're doing it under difficult circumstances, it's a brutal task. And actually, people really can get isolated. So a lot of the services we have are about people getting to know each other, you know, making friends, as well as doing either employability programs or parenting courses or whatever it might be. Because social, to feel alive and connected with other people is so important.
And Karen, we've seen numerous studies coming out, particularly in recent years, showing the profound negative physical effects of prolonged loneliness on people. It shortens lives.
It does, as does stress and as does poverty. It shortens the lives of the children in the families and impedes their development and growth emotionally and physically, as well as the adults. So it's really important that we include people, that we make sure people are lifted out of poverty or supported to be able to do better for themselves, and that we don't leave people behind. I mean, what was great in COVID, we really saw a very serious response to the needs of older people who couldn't get out, who were very isolated. And what we also saw in one family through COVID were the parents and children who were desperately isolated in their own homes and didn't have the kinds of family or community connections that people need. So that's a really serious thing as well. And we're also, for example, seeing now that, you know, some people are being turned away from vaccination centres if they go with their children. Now, obviously, it's not ideal to bring children.
Yeah.
But if you have to, if you don't have anyone else to mind your child, we heard of someone with a newborn strapped to her who wasn't allowed in.
That's ridiculous.
We need an alternative. It is ridiculous. So they have to be, the vaccination centres have to accommodate everyone. We want everyone vaccinated. So they have to accommodate people who have no other choice. And what the research showed is a quarter of people have no one else to help them in an emergency situation. But that's a really serious thing as well.
Well, Karen Kiernan, Chief Executive of One Family, thank you indeed for joining us there. The very stark results of the CSO's latest Pulse survey.